Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Dacia Eaton of KSKA, and Sean Dugan of the Alaska Dispatch. We are taping just before noon on Friday, and we just heard Governor Parnell had a press conference at which he turned down Medicaid expansion. Paul, he called the Medicaid expansion part of a failed experiment, the Obama Health Care Act, and he said that Medicaid, more generally here in Alaska and elsewhere, is broken and unsustainable.
Unsustainable, yeah. Had he expanded, it would have affected 26 to 40,000 low-income Alaskans, mostly without children. It would have also helped hospitals who get stuck with the bills for people who show up in emergency rooms and demand care. He has always been reticent about signing on to this because he doesn't trust the federal government. He asked the question, can states trust the federal government not to cut and run on its share? It would pay for 100% in the early years, and that drops back to 90%, but he's afraid that at some point...
What you're telling us here is he's being totally consistent with his approach up to now.
Nothing has changed. It would have been inconsistent had he gone ahead and expanded Medicaid. This is totally consistent.
Were you surprised they would hold a press conference in the middle of November to announce this?
No, I'm not. He's got a task force out there. He's got all kinds of things going on too. I'm not surprised by it at all. This is just the next step.
He did announce that he is forming a group that will look into Medicaid and its various problems, what needs to be done, and report in a year, which politics a year is several centuries
eternity,
for most politicians.
Yeah.
I'm sort of wondering about perhaps early to have any details on the politics, but there's some people here who are going to be pretty unhappy about his decision, and they're not going to necessarily be the recipients of Medicaid.
No, there was a lot of support for the governor expanding Medicaid. I think we were talking earlier, 24, 26 states that are not going to participate, I think, in the federal exchanges. But a lot of Alaska Native organizations supported this. I know that the Hospital Association supported this.
Chamber of Commerce
supported this. And they looked at not just what it would do for low-income Alaskans, but what it would do for the economy of the state. There was a lot of talk about how expanding Medicaid would impact the economy, the state economy, in a plus way. You know, the governor's been, you were asking why now. The governor's been under a lot of pressure to release that Lewin report that he commissioned about this very thing. Yes, I believe they did it for New Hampshire or Vermont as well. The governor his office has said at least that they won't release that report, and it'd be interesting to see if that report will ever come out, because a lot of people speculate that it contained much the same information that several other reports that have come out contain, and that's saying that expanding Medicaid in Alaska would be a good thing economically.
And the governor said that's an internal working document. Is that his position?
Yep, he's claimed executive privilege, that it's part of an internal discussion. So we have a new task force after we've paid a group of consultants to look at the same issue, and now we've got a task force for a year. Will anything come of that task force? I'm sure they'll have a report.
Although I think if the governor would say that we're going to look at Medicaid as it is in the state today rather than the expansion, that this has, wouldn't he be arguing that this is a new task for this?
And it may be, I don't know. As we're talking here on Alaska Edition right now, the governor is just wrapping
up
his
press
conference.
Okay, a whole lot of things are being
formed. So, yeah.
Moving right along, give me tennis courts or give me ice rinks. Anchorage has become embroiled in a battle over legislative appropriation for tennis courts or ice rinks or jumbotrons. Dacia, can you explain this unusual story for us?
It's been hard to tell what's going on, even for the reporters who go to all the assembly meetings and keep track of it, right, Sean?
Yeah.
So as far as I understand it, this all started when the assembly sent a request down to Juneau last session for a bunch of capital improvements, yeah, for buildings around town. It was, around $37 million for upkeep and repair of these buildings. And when they sent down that request, they asked for some money for the library, among many other things, for upkeep and maintenance. And when that came back, the chair of the assembly told me the library part was gone, but there was this new rec center inserted. which has tennis courts in it, which is over by the Turnagain, kind of Spinard-Turnagain area. So he doesn't quite know what happened. Lindsay Holmes was on the Finance Committee. She admittedly,
House Finance Committee.
She admittedly, you know, worked to get this in there. She's been pretty clear about that. The mayor supports it. What happened to the library request? Nobody really knows. Library supporters showed up to the assembly meeting and were all fretting and concerned. One person even said, pieces of the library building are falling down and almost hitting pedestrians, yet we're getting these tennis courts. And then on the other side, all these supporters of the tennis courts showed up with these green tennis ball stickers and testified about how great tennis would be because if we had it at the tennis courts, indoor tennis courts at a rec center, this would open up tennis to more people in the community who may not be able to afford a private tennis membership. Is that how you saw it, John?
Yeah. John, I want to add one thing, Sean, that we just learned, you just learned, that there's going to be a press conference while we're right here that's going to tell us some more, and who's holding that, and...
Okay, yes, the Alaska Tennis Association, which is the group that sought the $10.5 million to build six indoor tennis courts and two half-court basketball courts over next to Dempsey Anderson in Turnagain, they asked for the money. They're having a press conference at the Spinard Rec Center here just the moment we get done taping, so... You know, it's been a back and forth volley, kind of to use the pun here, to keep the thing going between the assembly, who felt, many on the assembly felt surprised, as Dacia mentioned, when this money request comes back and, oh, there's money for tennis courts in there. There was other things jammed in there. There was $4 million for the McDonald's Center, Rec Center in Eagle River that also wasn't requested by the city. There's a lot of backstory as to how this ended up in the SIP and the request from Anchorage, or why wasn't it in the request from Anchorage. Bottom line now is, though, the assembly has this hot potato. They've got this $10.5 million, and they're trying to figure out how to kind of, you know, to slice Solomon's baby here and make everybody happy. They're, you know, one assembly member wants to take some of the money and spread it out to the aging facilities in Anchorage and use some of the money for tennis. Another one is looking at potentially buying Alaska Club North, because all the indoor courts in Anchorage are privately owned. It is a growing sport. I mean, the Tennis Association does have a point there. It's the fastest growing, at least in Alaska nationally, traditional sport, although all traditional sports are kind of on the decline.
Now, as this story unfolded, I got the impression, I'd like your guidance here, that there was a certain amount of almost class rivalry in this, that there were certain kinds of people who play tennis and certain kinds of people who get out there and either skate or hit somebody with a hockey stick.
I think it's characterized that way, most certainly, is that we look at tennis as kind of a highbrow sport, a sport of the elite, although, to be fair, the Tennis Association says...
They could bring out thousands of people, or hundreds.
Yeah, well, it's also low density. You get four people maximum on a court. It's not a lot of people using a lot of square footage, right? But the Tennis Association says that the reason to have indoor courts is to allow lower-income kids to get access to tennis year-round, and that's kind of their whole argument for that. So, I mean, it does have that air, though.
Hockey rinks even got into this, right? I mean,
yeah,
now
because
the
some of the money goes
saying,
to the hockey rinks, to fix up hockey rinks.
Why don't we just use it for hockey?
And it turns out that everybody involved can make a pretty good case for why they deserve the money, right, Sean?
Absolutely. The problem is, unless they do something with it, it goes back to Juneau at a certain point. And when's the last time you ever saw a local government hand money back? So my sense is some kind of deal will come out of this. Yeah. Everybody will probably be holding their nose at the end of the day, but some kind of deal will come out of this, and there will be some kind of access to indoor courts, although I'm dismayed it's taken over a month and a half of assembly meetings to get us to this.
It's a sign of the times, though. I mean, everybody's thinking, I got to get my money now because budget cuts, cutbacks. And so this is everybody's fighting for it.
Paul, assembly members say it's time to crack down on towing firms. Why are towing firms in the spotlight in such a unfavorable light? And what are lawmakers suggesting?
Nobody likes towing firms. That's all there is to it.
Except the people who own them.
Except
for
that. And I wish I had stock in them myself. Assemblyman Traney and Honeman have decided, again, they tried this in 2008, I guess, in 2011, to rein in the towing industry in Anchorage. They're worried about the exorbitant rates. They're worried about people having to wait all weekend to get their car back and then pay a huge amount of money, and who has the right to tow what where, and all of that. And they want it all sorted out. And that's where we're headed here again. And whether they'll get it this time, I don't know. Traney swears he'll never give up. He says the towing industry here looks at Anchorage like it's harvest time and sends out these trucks to get whatever they want. I don't know if it's that bad or not.
It's a pretty gifted metaphor, it whatever
was,
else.
It was pretty nice, wasn't it? It's like he's got a writer or something. So it's one of those, the public is screaming, some assemblymen are going to jump up. Others are not going to care.
And assembly members get phone calls from people who are mad and say, I didn't see any sign.
There was no sign.
Then there is a sign out there.
$400, that's an outrage. That's what they, they get those calls.
Okay. Sean, we've heard this before and we are hearing it again. There's a plan to combine municipalities' fire and police dispatch centers. What are the consultants in this case offering, and what has been the response?
Well, the first thing I think is most people go, what, they have different dispatch centers? There's one 911, but most people don't realize that from there it gets routed to two different places. The Anchorage Fire Department maintains its own dispatch center, and APD maintains its own, and in typical government fashion they use different software, which doesn't always work together. The consultants say down the road it's a great idea. Because you're likely to save money. There's some efficiencies of time that could also happen there. The problem is the growing pains or the transition period between taking two separate systems and integrating them into one. You also, interestingly enough, 911 isn't a system that can ever really go down. It can't have downtime, so there are backups built in. For instance, if something goes down with either APD or AFD, which happened, there was a fire at the APD dispatch center in the early 2000s, they moved to the Emergency Operations Center, which the city maintains for disasters. It has a dispatch capability. Well, in 20, 30 minutes, and they actually train this once a year, it takes them to get there. They don't have any place to go if there's not a fire dispatch center. So currently, if theirs goes down, they send a guy with a radio over to the fire department, and he stands there like in the olden days, and he calls out all the dispatches using the fire department's call taker.
After somebody hands him something on a piece of paper?
Exactly, but you lose that 30 minutes. So theoretically, if there was one dispatch center and there was something happened to it, and you picked up the phone and called 911, you would get a deadline. I mean, that's one of the drawbacks of combining. It does save money. But again, there are
how much money are we talking about here, estimated?
There are estimates ranging from millions of dollars a year to hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. It really depends on how it's implemented. Is it going to be one center with two separate rooms and fire department employees, APD employees? Is it going to be one center where everybody works for one, everybody works together, dispatches, police, and fire? I mean, there's five different options in that report, the matrix report that they had just released. And it's something they've been looking at for a while. They have to do something soon because the contracts for the software they use to run their dispatch centers expire next year.
And who will make this the final decision here?
The final decision will be made by the city.
City meaning the mayor, the assembly, or both?
I believe it's administrative decision, but he is getting input from the assembly as well, because they'll have to appropriate money to make this happen.
Thank you very much. I'm Michael Carey, and I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Dacia Eaton, and Sean Dugan. Dacia, another hardy perennial. The Anchorage Assembly has been hearing a rewrite of Title 11, the law that regulates taxicabs and similar for-hire services.
Yeah, and if it tells you anything, they've been working on this since last April, and Debbie Osiander's the one who introduced it, and she's no longer on the Assembly. Recently, Dick Traney has taken it up. Last week we heard testimony from all kinds of people in the industry, taxi drivers, dispatchers, ordinary citizens, restaurant associations. Basically, nobody liked it. Everybody had a problem with it. I don't remember anybody saying anything
with the
positive.
Rewrite or the original document, or both?
Yeah, both. They don't like the old one, and they don't like what's being done. Some of the big concerns are service to Eagle River. That comes up again and again. Late night service at Bar Break downtown, just not enough taxis down there. They want taxi stands down there. That's another concern. Some of the drivers were really getting upset because I guess that the Assembly is considering making them switch the type of car, rear-wheel drive and front-wheel drive. They want to get rid of the one with the less traction.
Rear-wheel.
Somebody help me here. And rear-wheel drive. And the drivers were kind of freaking out because they were like, hey, that's a big investment for us to replace our cars. I think they'll likely phase in the cars over time. That's kind of my take on it. And Trainee says there'll be lots of amendments on Tuesday, and we'll see what happens.
Sean, you're familiar with this as well?
A little bit, in that I've sat next to Daisha at the assembly meetings, where frankly they become kind of a cornucopia of ongoing issues. I mean, the last three assembly meetings have seen things continued and continued. Taxis is just the tip of that iceberg. I did notice a lot of discord or a lot of displeasure with the way things are and with the proposals from the disabled community. There was a lot of talk about not having cabs that can handle disabled people, and how do we regulate that industry so that there are enough cabs out there that if you have a disability and you call and say you have some special needs, you've got a service dog or you have a wheelchair, that they send you the right cab. I mean, story after story at the assembly was they wait, you know, 45 minutes and the guy shows up, he can't help him, he turns around and drives away.
So. And not just that he can't help them, he can't get them in the car or whatever, but a lot of discrimination, a lot of stories of discrimination. And people were also saying there needs to be some kind of review process, there needs to be some kind of accountability and some kind of structure that people are required to follow if they're going to pick people up who have disabilities.
Over the years, I would just say, Dish, I've talked to cab drivers quite a bit about the reform, and they feel, I've never met a cab driver who was in favor of the existing system or the changes. They feel that it's sort of rigged against them, and the ones who own their vehicles feel that it's going to decrease the value of the vehicle. And I was thinking, Sean, that the ones I've talked to also about Eagle River, when people say there's not enough service in Eagle River, what they don't like, the drivers don't like, is I'm down here in front of the Hilton, I get a call in Eagle River, I get out there and either somebody's not there, they've got it in right, or it's a $3 cab ride. So how do we solve that?
That comes to permits, right?
Yeah, you're gonna have to section off, you're gonna have to make sections of the city as they do in larger cities where you can operate, right? You can pick fares up. But I mean, I think we've all hit on the idea that there's a lot going on. The wheels are spinning on the taxi cab changes, but the car isn't really going anywhere. Just kind of doing one of those glazing the ice and sinking in slowly and more slowly.
So. Welcome to the metaphor show.
Yeah.
Sean, NOM is investigating the possibility of using geothermal resources to produce power for the city and surrounding area. We've discussed this before, but there's some recent developments. What do you know?
Well, they drilled. They need to find enough water and water hot enough that they can produce 2 megawatts. That's the threshold for making it feasible to sell to the NOM Joint Utility System, which is the utility service out there. they've been looking for that combination for decades out at Pilgrim Hot Springs. They drilled their first well. They drilled at production size, which means that when they were done, they could hook it up to something. They found plenty of water, but the water wasn't warm enough. I think it was 170 degrees. They want it up near 190, not quite boiling, because they use a process that doesn't use boiling water. But the colder the water, the less efficient it is. They drilled a second hole after that. Again, the water wasn't quite hot enough. Basically, if you can imagine a giant reservoir of water under the earth, and at the very bottom of that is the heat source.
And how far, if they did get it at the right temperature, how far would they have to transport it?
Well, they would build the plant on site, so the water would
be converted into electricity
on site.
Right there.
It would be converted. It's basically box technology these days with geothermal. They have a similar plant in Chena Hot Springs, the only functioning one in Alaska. And then the expensive part of the project is stringing 60 miles of electrical line, transmission line to Nome.
I think you said it was $500,000 a mile?
It is, $500,000. Per mile. So it's, you know, $30 million to get you the 60 miles from Pilgrim Hot Springs to Nome just for the transmission lines. I'm told by everybody involved that it pencils out if they can find the water that's hot enough. And they just haven't been able to pinpoint that location. You know, as water comes up from the earth, it mixes in with groundwater and other waters and cools down. They need to get right over the spot where that heat source is so that they can find water.
And then they drill, is that correct?
Yeah, they drill. Well, they drill to find it, and once they do, they'll drill a bigger hole to make it a production size, and then they can scale.
I suppose the amount, the number of feet they have to drill varies depending on where they are.
It does.
But it ranges from what to what, or if you know.
I seem to recall it was about 350 feet. Bedrock isn't that far down there. They're right on the ocean almost, so it's not as far as you mean. It's not thousands of feet deep we're talking here. And that's one of the reasons it is a geothermal springs, is that the heat source is close to the
right, earth. Right. That's what they called it. Paul, Alaska Airlines says it will let passengers use more electrical devices while aloft. What is Alaska's plan?
They're planning a gate-to-gate, as they like to put it, service for these devices, as long as it's not takeoff or landing and you're not below 10,000 feet. If you're above 10,000 feet and flying, you're going to be able to use these things starting Saturday. I guess Horizon and SkyWest will be next week, the week after, same thing. And it's going to be very convenient for people, I think, to use their laptops and all of that up there. They're trying to put in 110 outlets so that you can recharge these things even as you're flying. So we're moving ahead into the future.
So your airplane, the airplane will be more like your living room or perhaps your car? Or
yes, yeah, if you like really small seats and cramped spaces, yeah.
Okay, and I think our audience wants to know, how far are we from cell phone use in the cockpit, in the passenger's cabin during flight?
I don't know that. I wish I did. I don't know that.
Sean, I can hear something.
We're a ways away. I can tell you, I actually looked into this at one point in my career when I was young and idealistic. Basically what happens, especially over the lower 48, is when you're at 20,000 feet, your phone has access to a lot of cell towers. Mm-hmm. So imagine all the planes with all the people in the sky, and their phone is accessing maybe 50 to 100 different cell towers at one time. Now, if you're on the ground trying to connect to that cell tower, you're going to have a hard time if it's being connected to by every plane within a 200-mile radius. So that's one of the concerns. Is it from the safety aspect at all for the plane? It's for the cell companies that slow their service down.
You can enlighten me. I had a different view of this, which was the airlines were adopted this policy so that their passengers wouldn't kill one another. That the people who are talking on the cell phone about their divorce or where's the soap for the laundry or car doesn't run. Maintain the peace with the people sitting next to him who don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, well, there is some of that too. But the big thing is if it makes things slower down on the ground, then that's not something the cell companies are going to go for.
Okay, and I bet that's true. Dacia, returning to Anchorage, the mayor reports a labor deal with the Anchorage Municipal Employees Association, which has about 500 workers, your report told us. What's in this deal and why now?
It's the Anchorage Municipal Employees Association. It's the largest union with employees in the municipality that work for the municipality. They've agreed to wages, health benefits, incentive programs, and the term of the contract. Wages are a 1.5% increase in January 2014 and a 1.5% increase again in January 2015. The term is 2 years. The mayor came out with a big press release and said, we have this letter of agreement. And sort of touted this as, see, I told you, we're negotiating under the standards of AO 37, which is his labor law, which he's been trying to get through the assembly for, almost a year now or something. And of course, the unions have been fighting hard against this because it has a lot of limitations. It would take a lot of things that they consider their rights away from them. Of course, they're still negotiating. There are a lot of other things to negotiate.
So the mayor in part is saying, look at me, I can achieve peace in the valley.
Right. And then the unions are turning around and saying, hey, he may think he's negotiating by that, but it isn't law yet. So to us, this proves that we don't need it because we're negotiating just fine right now.
And who is in the AMEA?
It's all kinds of workers. They have everything from engineers to more clerical staff. It's a wide range.
But not police and not fire.
Not police and fire. That's different.
Okay, Sean, we've touched on the stories that are hearty perennials on this show today in particular. Now let's talk about something totally new, different, and fun.
A new problem.
Food trucks.
Yeah.
These mobile kitchens have appeared all over the United States. And in fact, a couple of the owners of food trucks and pioneers in this industry have become celebrity chefs, interviewed by Terry Gross and others. Now these particular vehicles are becoming popular here, moving kitchens, mm-hmm. and they are provoking a certain amount of controversy.
Well, anxiety maybe be a better way of putting that, Mike. Especially in the downtown core district, you're talking about, what is it, Gamble Street to L Street and Ship Creek to 10th Avenue. That's a special section of the city where if you're a business in there, you pay an extra little bit of property taxes. You've got a downtown association. Basically, the restaurants in downtown, some feel that it's not fair to allow, like, Mike Carey to pull up in his gourmet food truck out front of their restaurant.
Coming to you Friday night.
Right, and feed the parking meter for a few hours and start dishing out food on the city street. You know, the people that currently sell hot dogs and reindeer dogs and hamburgers on the streets, on the sidewalk, they have to pay a pretty penny to get a permit, so it's up to 20 grand for a summer just to be there. But you don't pay anything to pull into a parking spot. And so in looking at this fight, the city realizes that, hey, we don't really have any rules for these guys. So they're looking at other things that other cities are doing. One of the big things is in Seattle and Portland, they're using food trucks. They bring them in after hours, after the restaurants close, at say 10 o'clock, so that they're serving food during the last few hours of the bar night, so that bar break is less violent. It gives people, it spreads them out. It gives them something else to do, something else to look at. And we've had, as I'm sure everyone's aware, a series of pretty violent incidents.
Some of those cities, they have park in Portland, it's almost permanent. They're not trucks, they're little
sheds. It's called a pod. They're looking at that. Is there a place in Anchorage where, you know, it's not within so many feet of this restaurant, or it's not gonna take up this part of the highway system road? By the way, 6th Avenue apparently is part of the highway system, so you can't use that. But is there a place where we could let them to be there semi-permanently? So these are all the discussions they're having. But as you mentioned, food trucks are incubators for small businesses many times. You start out with a food truck and then you end up with a restaurant. So, you know, there's concerns on both sides, but I think everybody's kind of heading in the direction of, we need to find a way to allow them to operate.
And they aren't necessarily cheaper. What they are is available, right?
They are. And, you know, you see them on construction sites a lot. You see them after events. Chilkoot Charlie's, a local bar, has a night where they invite a bunch of food trucks into their parking lot. And
well, we're going to have to invite ourselves out of your living rooms, because we're done right here for Alaska Edition. See you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.